the Thing, and the Invisible Girl.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, The Thing and The Invisible Girl from Marvel 2-in-1 number 32, cover dated October of 1977. So Ryan, what do you think of teaming up with one of your regular teammates? Like, doesn't this just risk being a Fantastic Four issue at some point?
It partially feels like a little bit of a cheat, but considering at the time, at least, and maybe make a case for it still, that the Invisible Woman was the least popular, the least, I want to say, the least seen, the least visible one of the group. I mean, it's not like he's teaming up with Johnny or Reed, though that would make it feel more like a Fantastic Four one. This one is like half Fantastic Four team up, but yeah, I'll let it slide because I like the character, and it's also because we still have several of our recent guest stars making appearances in this one. Three of them, if you count a cameo in one of the last pages.
It's still the Spider-Woman team up.
It is, yeah.
Okay, but nevertheless, Invisible Girl is on the cover, so let's preface with a reason or reasons why we like that guest character. What's so great about the Invisible Girl?
I don't just like her. I love this character. Invisible Woman is my favorite female Marvel hero. Okay. Monica Rambeau coming close behind that. Also, Spider-Woman, She-Hulk, the other great characters, the Wasp, too. But Sue is my favorite and has been pretty much since the Fantastic Four became my favorite Marvel property with the Mark Waid, Mike Waringo run. It's one of those things where, I think you'll probably make the case, because I've seen your notes, that she's sort of the real leader of the Fantastic Four, certainly in sort of modern depictions of it. And I think that's true to an extent, whereas Reed is definitely still the leader of the team, in as much as they commit to like fighting cosmic entities and bad guys and problems of that sort. But Sue is the leader of the family. And is that not the more important thing when it comes to these particular characters? She's the glue that holds them all together. She's the sister of Johnny. She's the wife of Reed. She's the potentially best friend of Ben, and certainly the one that he cares about the most. And I really like that. I've always kind of thought about her in a lot of modern depictions, both in the movies and other kind of more recent interpretations. They've tried to give her a career outside of the family. And I think that's to be a little bit more feminist and a little bit more, you know, women's empowerment. You know, she's not just the wife and the mother. And I think that's fine to an extent. I mean, I'm as pro-woman as anybody. I think my reputation stands for that. But I also don't want that to come at the expense of her being a wife and mother, as if that's not an asset in itself. Because, you know, I think that can be the most important thing, if it is, being the wife and mother. She is the glue. She is the rock. I like that aspect about her. And I also like, if they're going to give her some kind of career, some kind of job or interest outside of raising the kids and keeping Reed sane, I don't want it to be a science background, because I just think then it's like, it pales in comparison to her husband. Then she's not stepping out. She's not bringing anything new to the book or to her character or to the group that Reed hasn't already covered. It's kind of, in a weird sort of way, it's sort of my problem when they tried to pair Superman and Wonder Woman together as a romantic couple. And it's like, okay, well, Wonder Woman should be the alpha in any situation, any relationship she's in. But she can never be that with Superman. So I think that kind of negated the character. So if they want to give her like a job, like a humanitarian job, like she had in the more recent movie, that's cool. If they want to give her like a sort of business type of career or occupation or thing like that, fine with that. Don't make her another kind of scientist, because I think that just accentuates how the difference between her and Reed.
Yeah. Well, right now she's an archaeologist, I think, is what's happening in the comics.
All right. Okay, that's a different science, yeah.
Yeah, it's a different type of science, and it, you know, she has different opportunities because of that.
Not in like the you know, astrophysics or chemistry or those things. Like they,
yeah, then that's just redundant. And she started out as like a would-be actress, so
really true, yeah.
Yeah, I like the way you put it. As the leader of the family, I'm a big fan of the Invisible Woman as well, but not so much when she was just a girl. You know, I love the later. You came to it a bit late, so she was already the Invisible Woman, right?
Yeah, because I mean, I first discovered the Fantastic Four. Actually, probably the first time I saw her was on a trading card. It was like the Marvel Impel trading cards for her character solo, and then the team cards.
Because I love the later Mama Bear energy, and I think the best thing they ever did with her was acknowledging that she was the real leader, you know, or the heart of the team anymore, or the family, as you put it. I think that's a great way to put it and still give Mr. Fantastic his due. But I think Reed is too distracted for it, really.
Sure.
Like the nitty-gritty of the leadership, maybe the strategy during fights and so on, and obviously in the lab. But generally, I like how they made her more of a key character in the team, because originally, like very timid, and, you know, she's the smart one in the ways that count for that role, I guess is the way I'd put it.
Yeah.
And once we can have an Invisible Woman with proper agency, we'll discover that she's the most powerful and versatile member of the team. But originally, it's a lot of, I wish Reed were here. If only Reed would guide me. There was a lot of that throughout the Stanley and then Roy Thomas and this, et cetera, years. I think it's John Byrne finally flipped it.
Yeah. I mean, Stanley was very progressive with his characters up to a certain point. And I think Sue is the point where you find that most evident. It's like, yeah, cool. He made her a part of the team. He gave her a power, but there's some cringiness to some of the stuff with her, too. But.
Yeah. Well, let's track that by talking about Sue's publication history. Sue Storm, the Invisible Girl, debuts with the rest of the FF in Fantastic Four number 1, November 1961, by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. At first, a very demure character whose only power is invisibility. She's a literal wallflower.
Yeah.
She develops the ability to create invisible force fields in FF number 22 in January 1964. In the book's third annual, she'll become Sue Richards, marrying Reed after vacillating between his and the Submariner's affections. Not that this would stop after the wedding. In the fifth annual, she gives birth to Franklin. So he's been around since 1967, which is kind of surprising in a way. Right now, he's around 13, as the comic book time flies.
Precocious little 60-year-old, isn't he?
I can't say there's much of note going on in her life in the 70s. You know, just normal FF stuff. But when John Byrne takes over the book in the 80s, one of his missions seems to be to breathe new life into her character. He makes her more confident. And after she's taken over by Psycho Man and turned into the memorable villain Malice, she changes her code name to the Invisible Woman. Her powers start getting used to their fullest extent and more cleverly. She and Reed briefly become Avengers in the late 80s, but soon return to the team they founded, which is where I leave off and you begin.
Yeah, well, as we all know, at Marvel in the 1990s, if you weren't an X-Men book, you were a distant afterthought. So when Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan were doing their run on the Fantastic Four, they made it as much of an X-Men book as they could, which had pros and cons. For Sue, at least she took on a much more of a direct leadership role, actually taking place of Reed when he was sort of temporarily killed off. But while he was there, she also kind of emotionally abused Reed a little bit. And she also started to wear a more hyper-sexualized costume.
Famously.
Yeah. The boob window in the shape of a four. That's, you can't get much more direct and blunt than that. Nominally, this was because she was possessed by the villain Malice, as you mentioned before, but really it was because the villain called Marvel editorial. Since the start of the 21st century, where it feels like every issue of a Marvel comic is tied to some event or another, the Invisible Woman has appeared regularly in Fantastic Four, FF, related miniseries, etc. During the Civil War event, notably, she sided with Captain America. During the Secret Invasion event, she was briefly replaced by a Skrull. In 2019, Invisible Woman finally got her first ever solo miniseries written by Mark Waid. This story depicted an heretofore unknown part of Sue's past when she worked as a secret agent for Nick Fury's S.H.I.E.L.D. which is one of those ideas that it's like, yeah, if you had the power of invisibility, why wouldn't Nick Fury come to you right away and be like, I need you for this, especially during the Cold War?
And she is, of course, in the current FF series, whose car I am continually shining. In alternate media, she was, of course, part of the really every Fantastic Four cartoon, the ones in 1967, 1978, 1994, 2006. On film, she has been played by Rebecca Staub in the never-released 1994 version, by Jessica Alba in the two early 2000s films, by Kate Mara in 2015's Fan4Stick, and by Vanessa Kirby in last summer's FF First Steps.
I love the sort of like the Mandela effect almost, where now we just call the movie Fan4Stick as if that's what it was really called. It wasn't. It was Fantastic Four, but because of the way, like, everyone just thinks of it as Fan4Stick, that has become its name.
I'm happy to keep the tradition going.
Of course, ridiculous, but yeah, and I think we might have briefly touched upon this when the movie first came out, or one of our last recording episodes.
Yeah.
I love Vanessa Kirby in the new movie First Steps. I didn't know really much of anything about her. I don't think I had seen her in anything previous to that before the
Mission Impossibles or the...
Maybe.
Yeah, she's in the Mission Impossibles and she's in the Fast and Furious franchise through the Hobbs and Shaw movie.
I've seen one of the Fast and Furious and two of the Mission Impossibles, so it's possible I missed her in those. But no, she was great, and I thought they captured the character wonderfully. I thought they did a really good job with her, making her what we want to see her as, is sort of like the heart and soul, and her her emotional crisis kind of being the core of this galactic level, you know, threat of Galactus. Great stuff there.
Oh, and she was in The Crown. She's Elizabeth's sister.
I would have seen her in that.
I mean, they put everything that I want to see in the character in that portrayal, whereas earlier portrayals in films, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this is Marvel 2-in-1 number 32. It's called And Only the Invisible Girl Can Save Us Now. It's written by Marv Wolfman, with art by Ron Wilson and Pablo Marcos. Ben and Spider-Woman fight to contain the arachnid Alicia before Scotland Yard takes deadly measures against her. Ben calls in the cavalry in the form of Sue Richards, the Invisible Girl, who finally deals with the problem. Alicia is then cured by Professor Kort from a few issues ago. Meanwhile, the Hydra guy, whose plan this was, is executed at the behest of the Supreme Hydra, and Trevor and Chauncey lay hands on their treasure, but are immediately sucked into a mystical box. That's the issue. but let's look at the cover, which is, wow, by George Perez and Pablo Marcos. What do you think of this one?
I mean, George Perez, you know, it's hard to, you know, say anything bad about him, especially without, you know, drawing the wrath of our newest member, Sean Ross.
But I think we'll have to.
Yeah, I don't love the cover, and I think we probably have the same feeling about it. Like, if you took the spider web effect off of it, this would be maybe like 50% better, if not
it's
like
too
more
busy.
Than that. Yeah, and I think it's really just that, either take the web effect away or the city in the background. Take one of those. It's like too many layers. That's just throwing it off.
The coloring doesn't help, which is not necessarily, you know, George's fault, because it's like the city is in a greenish tint, and then Alicia's spider legs are also in a greenish tint, and obviously they look like lines, that the dark web, which is bluish, I guess, but I mean, it's all the same kind of tints, and everything gets lost.
Yeah.
I think he does a great Ben. The Thing looks really good, but the rest of the characters are maybe, you know, weaker. This is a weak cover for him, sadly. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
Spider-Woman is in her usual boring flight pose. I mean, she's always drawn like this, you know. I don't love it.
We'll get into a much more dynamic pose for the character very soon.
Okay, that's a promise. Let's get inside the book. And as we left things off, Alicia was a spider creature intent on killing the Thing. Mind controlled. There's a chip on her forehead that gives her vision, but also under the control of Hydra. And she is fighting both Spider-Woman and the Thing in a mall. I think there was a department store there. That's not necessarily important here, because we soon will leave this this building. You know, earlier on, it's really about the Thing trying to stop, in this case, Spider-Woman from hurting Alicia. So it's like he's defending the monster, throughout. You know, the cops are going to come in, same thing. It's like he's always trying to defend the yeah. other monster.
That came very close to being my dumb move of the issue. It's just the fact that he's constantly putting other people or the city of London itself, like just the infrastructure, at risk trying to protect Alicia. And it's like, okay, I know that she's the woman you love, and I get it, but let's prioritize or something. Pages 2 and 3. First of all, is this the first time we've gotten a double page splash in this book?
I don't know. I mean, it depends if we mean like just us going through it or if this is like all through the 32 issues.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I can't remember all of them as closely as that, but certainly I think the ones that we've been doing.
Your impression may be right, may be wrong, may be right, but I think part of it is that Ron Wilson and this era of Marvel, where there's like, it's 17-page stories,
mm-hmm.
makes the art usually pretty cramped.
Right, right.
So when we see a big splash, which isn't even a two-page splash because there's like bands on both sides. There's, you know, there's actually 6 other panels in this mm-hmm. two-page spread. He tends to make things claustrophobic either because the story is too long for the yeah. number, for the page count, or because that's just his style. But we get, you know, a splash page on the first page is always a splash page. But then immediately afterwards, as big an art piece or bigger, it may not be the first time, but it's certainly rare.
Also, wholly expletive deleted the depiction of Spider-Woman in this one. Because we talked about in one of the earlier issues when we were talking about her and her costume, and I talked about the sort yep. of minor controversies that arose with the way that she had been drawn sometimes. In particularly the way certain artists depicted her posterior.
Right.
This shot, like, if she was wearing a skirt, this would be pornographic. Like, this is, like, this is, okay.
Very butt forward.
Not just butt, but like everything in the lower part. Like, it's, yeah, it's a little bit crazy. It's dead center of a 2-page splash. I mean, that's where your eye goes, and it's kind of comical.
You're reacting to what the girls of the Hot Squad call the thigh gap.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And what
yeah.
that may evoke.
I would have had a different word, but yeah, that's certainly much better. I'll take their word for it.
Well, I'm trying to keep it a family show.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why I said expletive deleted instead of my usual response.
By page, original page 7, but page 5 of the scan, for example, if you're using a scan, mm-hmm. we are heading back to Big Ben, which yes. was the brief sight of the Thing, Spider-Woman battle earlier, and I think probably Chauncey and Trevor are inside there somewhere. I think they're in this general area. One of the things I find interesting about the issue is that Alicia keeps developing new powers or showing off new powers. I think her mutation is just like keeps evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Here she's spitting the web out of her mouth, which yeah. I don't think we saw before. So she's more and more monstrous. And I think we'll see other abilities as we go through.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's much method to that or if they're just like, yeah, whatever she needs for this particular panel or something.
Yeah, I mean, she needs to be more and more difficult to stop. This is also the page where Ben calls for help.
It's one of those things where it's like, okay, this is a logical thing to do. If you're in this situation, call for backup. You need help. Obviously, you're emotionally hampered by this situation, and it seems like this threat has got you and your co-star on the ropes. You need backup. But it's like, it's before cell phones or the internet technology, so he has to find an actual payphone.
You know, one of the things that I find a little ridiculous, but thinking back, it's kind of true, is that for all their technology, mm-hmm. and the Fantastic Four are a very technological team, you yeah. know, Reed is building all these devices and vehicles, and they got stuff in their belt to get into even the elevator of the Baxter mm-hmm. building, and we've seen some of this stuff in this series. However, they don't have signal devices, right? It's like, yeah. oh no, we need to warn the rest of the team, assemble the team, and Johnny flies up and draws a 4 in flames, or Reed stretches up and does a 4 in stretch. Can't you guys create a like a cell phone? I mean, the Justice League had signal devices as early as the 60s. So,
true. I was going to say that's failure of imagination on the writer's part, but yeah. That's
so they don't have that, and he goes into a phone booth.
It's called long distance.
I feel bad for him because the way that Ron Wilson draws the touch pad, there's like a billion buttons.
Yeah.
And Ben has massive fingers. I don't know. He might have gotten a wrong number.
I just thought of this. This is a weird little tangent, but there was a Simpsons episode, and God, I can't believe that show's still on. This goes way back to the 90s, whatever, like 7th or 8th season.
So I have a good chance that I haven't seen it.
Yeah, but there's a Simpsons episode when Homer, for whatever reason, like gained a ton of weight and became like 400, 500 pounds, and he had to like work from home, and he was sitting, and he had to call like for an emergency thing, and he was like pushing the buttons on the, and it just had this automatic recording voice said, "The fingers you have used to dial are too fat. Please hang up and try again." We were just like something, smash the keypad with your hand to get a replacement or something.
Even on the next page,
yeah.
You can see Ben is punching the phone.
Yeah, there's an impact.
This is also the page where we get our little bit of Trevor and Chauncey. Don't you just love these characters?
Has there ever been a subplot that you cared less about than these guys?
They're going to become the main plot at some point.
At some point.
I think next time,
yeah.
Right? It's got to be next time.
Yeah, kind of, but it's like... Even making one of them an ex-Nazi didn't make them more interesting to me. Like,
well, what about making them the prequel to Mulholland Drive?
Yeah, open the case and just get sucked in. Yeah,
I mean, it's supposed to be just plates. It is. It's not just supposed to be. You see it. There's supposed to be counterfeit pounds, plates for him anyways. And his plan is a very mature, I think, plan where he's not going to... Originally, it was meant to, you know, destabilize the British economy during the war. But here he's going, we're going to, you know, we're going to print just enough bills and not disrupt the economy and
yeah.
slowly get rich. He's an old man with old man plans. But nevertheless, somehow, this box sucks him and Trevor or Chauncey or whichever is which into, I don't know, another dimension or...
We'll find out in the next issue. But
I will tell you that the next issue is mystical, according to the guest star. So whatever this is, let's not talk about it anymore.
Okay.
Move on to page 7, where here it is. It's the cops, some bobbies on horseback, are riding in, and they just start shooting at Alicia. And it's kind of a crazy page because there also seems to be a fire. I don't know what started the fire.
Not Billy Joel.
So I don't know where the fire comes from, and it's ignored in other pages. So, okay.
That's one of Alicia's other powers that we haven't seen before. It just starts...
Like, maybe that van exploded or something, sure, you know, that they rode into the building. But who knows? There's also this web that she's created is massive.
Yeah.
So this is a crazy page, which is followed by the thing attacking the cops, pulling the street out. You can see, like, even...
Yeah, girders, the support struts, yeah.
Right out and, like, under the horses, and the horses are sort of ramping on this piece of land. Again, there's fire. Maybe there's, like, gas mains in there or something that were broken.
After he's ripping up the street, certainly, yeah. And, I mean, endangering the cops is one thing. You know, that mileage might vary, but endangering horses. The horses, I'm like, dude, Ben... Calm down.
He's turning monstrous, you know, by protecting. It's Frankenstein and the Bride of at this point. And you can tell, like, those cops, and they're grizzled. There's, like, older. There's an older cop there, and he remembers World War II, and it's like, never again.
Can we also mention that the cops bring up an interesting question? They refer to Captain Britain. And it's like, once you mention that, it's like, yeah, why don't we see him? We've been in the UK for like 5 issues now. Where is Captain Britain? Why isn't he one of... We got Shang-Chi. Why don't we...
Well, I'll tell you where Captain Britain is. Around this time, he was in Marvel Team-Up, which I covered with Martin Gray at some point on this show. And he's going to college. He's like taking a course in college in the US. He's Peter Parker's roommate. So that's where he is. He's out of the country.
Okay.
Because he would have been a good guest star here.
Yeah, okay, so he's in the U.S. at the time. He's in New York.
Yes.
Brian, you had one job.
Especially since your powers work better in the U.K. Why go study abroad? That's a problem for Marvel Team-Up, not for this issue. But those cops are kind of turning against Ben, and I feel like, that's proper.
Yeah, it's justified.
And we get like a mini splash on the next page. Chapter 2, where he's like holding off. You see the guns. The cops are up against him. He puts himself in between the police and Alicia. And they sort of decide to let that happen. It's like, okay, well, you deal with it, but if you can't deal with it, then we'll start shooting.
At the top of this page, we see that Spider-Woman is still webbed up, shoulders right. to toes, but to me, the webbing effect looks more like fishnets than webs. Now, maybe that's just me and me bringing my own little psychological, you know, predilections to the image, but to me, it looks drawn more like fishnets than webs.
I had the same impression, especially since you see like the definition of the legs,
her butt,
the butt, and et cetera. Yeah. So the same way that her costume is sort of painted on, it looks like she isn't in a cocoon.
She's in a fishnet bodysuit leotard.
Yep, that's what it is. You know, soon enough, Ben is going to rip out the chip.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of slow to come to that idea, right? Because it's Mentallo and Fixer just did that to him and Nick a few issues ago, which would be a few days ago for him.
Right.
That's suspicious, the chip
on
her forehead. He rips it out. It makes her blind again, I guess, but it also will drive her bananas. So she's out of control. She's still a monster and out of control after this. So it wasn't a great move, but I think it was the smart move given the information he had.
Sure, yeah. If you think that's the controller, then, you know, that neuters, you know, Hydra's control over her. Now, it doesn't resolve the issue. It just makes her kind of wild and unhinged, but he didn't know that going into it. It seemed like a sound plan.
Yeah, so I don't begrudge him that particular move. Cut to Hydra headquarters. Basically, it's a replacement of the masks, I guess, because they're like the one guy, Agent 4, has failed. Supreme Hydra's angry, and he orders Cooler Mask Hydra Agent 8 to kill him and take his place. So we're seeing a promotion in action, I guess. Supreme Hydra is super buff. He's the one who should fight Ben.
I was going to say, did it seem to you that the art in this page might not have been exactly in sync with the dialogue? Like that panel with like the Supreme Hydra, the way he's looking, like he's got a like Kirby crackle around him, his chest is kind of out, his hands are looking like they're kind of like tense or clenched or something like that. Like that to me seemed like that guy was in pain. Like I imagine that being like he's going to be like discharged into like matter or something like that. And I was just like that.
So you're thinking that's not the Supreme Hydra. That would be Agent 4.
Yeah. Like there's something like weird, like, yeah, like that could have been something. Yeah, yeah. I just kind of got the impression. I was like, that seems like the dialogue is talking to the wrong character or something like that. Or or Ron Wilson was drawing something different and then the script kind of changed the perspective. But I don't know.
That asks us to care about Hydra more than we do, I guess. Back to the fight. And she's strong enough to punch Ben in a significant way at this point. Speaking of strength, Spider-Woman just snaps out of her webs. A bit like she could have done this all along.
It took like 7 pages.
If she was like squirming out of them or something and it took time, no. Snap. She's out. So I felt like, okay, this is... The page does have an unusual POV shot because we see monstrous Alicia without dialogue, without anything coming at us. In other words, coming at Ben. So we get Ben's POV. So that's an interesting bit that we don't normally get. But yeah, the whole page is about really Spider-Woman finally getting free and then joining the fight. I don't know why it took so long.
Page 5 to 12, she was incapacitated. And she tells Ben, she's like, well, you did that, but now she's, well, we presume that she's blind again because they took control. And that makes Ben sad that he cost her sight, and he starts to cry.
He's an emotional wreck.
Yeah.
Then we get more Spider-Woman on Spider-Woman action. And significantly, again, another power. Alicia now has the same sting, electric blast that Spider-Woman does.
Yeah.
Which makes sense since, you know, she's based on...
Based on that. So it's like maybe it's taking her longer to develop some of these powers. They're like kicking in at different times, or she's just using them based on instinct.
And bam, the Invisible Girl is there.
Very small and a very cramped panel. Like she, for our title, like even though like she's not really, but even like this is the title guest star, she needed a bigger intro, like a more dynamic and more signature, you know, introduction to this story.
I mean, arguably, she needed more than the 4.5 pages that she got the whole issue, you know, being the supposed guest star. So she comes in, Deus Ex Machina in a way. You're right, very cramped panels. And this is what I was talking about earlier. And she's the Invisible Girl that I don't like. you know, I wish Reed were here. And like, she doesn't put her best foot forward. She creates a field around the Alicia, and then Alicia breaks through it. So, oh no, I didn't create a one that's powerful enough. Yeah. Why didn't you? Right. It's that kind of thing. You know, at least she has some gumption, some bravery. She starts climbing the, so she's still not using those force fields as floating platforms at this point, I guess, which we know it's a trick that she definitely uses later. And she starts climbing the web to get close. And she's using the force field as a sort of punching arm. Okay. And eventually, only very eventually, because she falls off the webs and has to be caught, etc. And only then will she choke a sister out, as I say, which is, you know, like put a bubble around Alicia's head to make her pass out. But it takes a while for her to get there. At least she's sort of like fighting the monster alone. She at least gets that moment.
Right. And I mean, has the presence of mind to keep the force field around her, like suffocating her while she's falling, possibly to her death if Ben doesn't catch her. Mm. So that at least was pretty cool. Like, is this the first time? I'm not familiar enough with the Fantastic Four of the 70s, but I'm trying to like think, like, because this becomes a pretty go-to move that Sue uses a lot. Is like, if there's a threat, she can just use the invisible force field to cut off their oxygen. And I was like, is this the first time she's tried that? Like, I just wondered if this was actually more of a historic occasion for her powers, but
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I mean, Marv Wolfman was writing FF as well at this point. Mm-hmm. So it's probably a trick that he used there. I would say that this is like the kind of thing that would happen for the first time in a team-up book if there's a guest writer or a different writer who has different ideas.
Right.
But if it's the same writer as FF, probably she's been doing this in FF as well.
Yeah.
I would say. She's only using it late in the game here because it's supposed to be a friend. And she doesn't want to risk killing Alicia.
Right.
So she only uses it as a last resort. But this Sue is, you know, I can only use one force field at a time, which is very far from the character that we know now. Is much more powerful.
I like Ben doing the introductions. Like he's like catching her up. He's telling her what's going on, everything. And he's like, oh, by the way, he mentions what Spider-Woman is doing. Oh, by the way, Webs, this is Susie Richards, the Invisible Girl. And then to Sue, he's like, and this here is Spider-Woman. No relation to you-know-which pain in the butt.
They're all caught up. We go back a few issues in a way because who will save Alicia now? It's Professor Kort, who was responsible for her condition. You know, like Hydra used him.
Look who's in the background. Remember Deathlok?
I remember Deathlok. He's the guy that they went to England to drop off at Professor Kort's in the first place. He's on the mend.
For us, that was like a year and a half ago.
At least. I don't know about Kort's dialogue here. He says, you know, it's like, you think you can change her back to normal, Doc? And he says, with prayers, anything is possible, which is a weird statement from a scientist. I don't know. I don't want to take his faith away from him, but it's an odd thing to say.
Maybe like biochemistry and prayers or
something? Yeah, a little bit of both, right?
You gotta bring something to the table.
And then there's the last page is really a pretty reasonable reaction from London. And if we compare this to how starstruck they generally were when the vacation began, now he's turned the whole city against him. You know, they're throwing cans at him and you know, ripe tomatoes, and he's just taking it. And at the end, we do get Alicia will be fine after all.
But that's not the end of their adventures in London.
Or England, at least, England, because says the next time beneath Stonehenge, which is a bit away from London, outside. Certainly. It's, you know, theoretically should be in Wales. Yeah, the vacation or the UK vacation is not over. We still got two chapters to go. Can you believe it? All right, who fared better, Ryan? How well does this fit each of the characters' atmospheres and stories? Is this a Thing story, or is it more of an Invisible Girl story? Or alternatively, you can choose Spider-Woman if you like. Because Sue, with name on the cover, comes in real late. So I'm asking.
She comes in real late, and Spider-Woman is there for the first couple pages and then is incapacitated for a lot of it. This is a Thing story, clearly. It's his emotional crisis that moves the plot because it drives his behavior the way he is, you know, at times hindering his friends from stopping her or hindering himself, hindering the cops, endangering the rest of Wonder Woman. Like, this is all about his crisis of not wanting to hurt the love of his life, even though she's become a monster who is threatening him and everybody else around. So it's all about the Thing, but it doesn't make him look great in the story. It's all about him, but in a bad way.
I mean, if there is a character in the Marvel Universe who has the best claim to the expression feet of clay,
yeah, there you go.
It's got to be Ben. What about cool moves? The Thing's cool move.
I mean, the one probably good thing that he does is ripping the controller off of Alicia's head, which indirectly leads to the death of the Hydra cell leader, which is kind of like Ben beating the villain, even though it happens very indirectly.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'll take it. I put down page 8, the splash for chapter 2, where he stands between the police and Spider Alicia. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty boss. It might be dumb, but it is cool.
Yeah.
I also like the sort of, I don't know, I think the Thing is a little bit more abstract or expressionistic, fish-eyed or something in that panel. So it stood out to me. What about the guests? Sue and or Spider-Woman moments?
I'll take Spider-Woman and you can take Sue.
Okay.
I like that. I mean, Spider-Woman has had this change of heart, this turn to a hero mode for like 6 minutes at this point. But right away from the beginning, she's like, we have to lead Alicia away from the public. Let's get her like isolated in her own so not innocent people don't get hurt. And like Alicia's going after Ben and like Spider-Woman like flies between them to draw her away like a heat-seeking missile. She's already thinking in those sort of conventional heroic terms of don't put innocent people in danger, something that Ben does not think about at all in this story.
No, he's a danger. Sue, well, she climbs up real high on the webs. Well, I mean, that's still a power move, and then she does finally beat the monster.
So yeah.
It's true that only she could save them all.
Right.
Dumb or weird moves? Ben's?
With the caveat that this was ultimately the right thing to do, stopping in the middle of the fight to go make a long-distance phone call from a payphone, the logic tracks, but it's just a really lame thing in the middle of the story for the hero to do. It's just like, there's no way of making that look cool for your hero to do, even though it is the right thing, and it ends up being what's needed for the resolution.
I think his dumb move is throughout. He causes more damage than Alicia does,
yeah.
If you look at it. So I think he totally deserves that local reaction at the end. You know, like, he screwed up. He screwed the pooch on this one. What about the guests? You want to do Spider-Woman again?
Sure. We kind of mentioned it. She disappears. She is webbed up in her fishnet outfit for, like, 7 pages. I think I got, like, page 5 to 12 out of only 17 pages. So, yeah, she's incapacitated, which would be okay if, like, the real guest star, Sue, came in earlier, but she doesn't, so it's... Spider-Woman is flying around. She's talking a lot. She seems to be having a plan, but she's just not there enough.
And in the weird category for me, there's absolutely no explanation ever given as to how Sue appears minutes after she got Ben's phone call.
Or why she's the only one.
Yeah. Maybe she was the only one available. I don't know what the other ones are doing. How did they get... I mean, even Ben, who took like a Quinjet type thing to Britain, still took longer than what seems to be the time here, give or take an adventure with Submariner.
If she had an adventure with Submariner along the way, that would have taken a lot more time.
Or, you know, maybe she was visiting Namor. And so she was real close.
She's already halfway there.
Yeah, but then how does she get the phone call? So it's, I don't know. If you're going to call some help, it better be local help if they're going to just show up within minutes. That never really made sense to me. All right, what about the unfriendly farewell? Because again, there's no goodbye. We're going to stay with some of these characters. But I think London is sure ready to be rid of him.
Yeah.
This is about as unfriendly as it gets. I feel like this is a perfect Ben moment. The ending with, at least with the locals.
Yeah, and we see him walking off with Sue, which makes sense. They're family and they're going off together. So it's not an unfriendly farewell because they're not saying goodbye to each other. They're live with each other. But Spider-Woman just disappears after the conflict is over. We have no idea where she's gone or what happens.
But she does show up next issue as well, doesn't she? I think she's still going to be around. And let's ask at the end here, this were your introduction to the Invisible Girl. Would you want to read more stories about her?
Based on this, No, not really. I like the way that she takes out Alicia in this sort of nonviolent way of it's creatively of using this force field to cut off her oxygen and just like drop her down to make her weak enough that she passes out. I think that's a good use of her power. I mean, they use it a lot nowadays, but it's cool. I like that. But if this was my first time seeing the character, no, this doesn't really make me need to see more of her unless I was reading the Fantastic Four.
Well, that's it. That's where you would see her, right? So, Right. Yeah, it doesn't make me hopeful that she's anything but a tedious underachiever in the Fantastic Four comic.
Yeah.
She seems so whiny and out of sorts. She's just a set of powers that shows up at the end.
Yeah.
To solve a situation. So there's not enough here to make you, you know, hook into the character. All right. Well, we'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, She Disappears Before Your Very Eyes. Is Miracle Girl just a regular magician, or is she something more? Could she be one of the fantastic gods that have started appearing all over the world? In her first landmark issue, the question is asked, but answers will have to wait while Dr. Bedloom crashes her show. Catch it before it's gone, only from Amalgam Comics. All right, we're back. Our monthly feature, the bonus team up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Invisible Girl team up. Or Invisible Woman, of course.
Yeah, prior to the movie that came out last summer, I think it was sort of jokingly stated, but not all that jokingly, that The Incredibles, the Pixar animated family film, was the best Fantastic Four film. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of validity to that. So I would have a sort of Fantastic Four and Incredibles team up. However, it wouldn't be the pairing that you might expect. I would have the Invisible Woman pair with Mr. Incredible. And the reason for that is because I think, like, if she's partnered with Elastigirl, then it's just the girls talking about the problems with the family and raising and everything, and like of being the woman who is, you know, neglected by her husband, who's too off in the superhero world to really think about her needs and the needs of the kind of the unit itself, and she has to hold everything together. And it just becomes girls just talking about, you know, the problems with their husbands, and it kind of gets in that.
And we've seen a lot of Sue teaming up with a stretchable hero, obviously in her own team.
Yeah. Right. But to put her with the man, the Reed's counterpart in The Incredibles, even though Mr. Incredible is not like Reed very much, not powers, not in intellect or things like that, but to sort of, if she was able to confront the perspective of the husband in that type of superhero family without having the emotional connection of it being her husband, and she has to judge it that way. I just think that would be an interesting sort of psychoanalytic way of getting an outsider's glimpse into their family and what Reed might be thinking about without being forced to like sit on the couch with Reed and get the answer from him, which he probably couldn't express coherently anyway.
Interesting. I have put Invisible Woman with H.G. Wells' Invisible Man. Sue is thrown back in time by Dr. Doom's flat square time machine and must survive in the Victorian era while Reed finds a way to track her down. She seeks the help of a local scientist called Griffin, who has already cursed himself with invisibility. He says he'll help, but, you know, he actually covets Sue's control over her powers, and it'll soon become a versus rather than a team up.
Ooh. the last five pages of that issue are just like a knockdown, drag-out fight that we can't even see because they're both invisible the whole time.
I love it. It's just shots of rooms.
Yeah. All of a sudden a chair breaks or something.
Oh, that would be great. I would love to have, and then maybe you get like a backup with the figures drawn in or something. There'd be like a two versions of the book.
Yeah. I wanna rock!
As usual, we're riffing on Ryan's deep interest in music. He is the host, the regular host of Fire and Water Records, and he will bring us his musical selection to go with the comic and its guest star. What are we listening to while we read this comic?
Ah, Siskoid, I am a prisoner to the arbitrary and unnecessary rules that I have created for myself, because my first choice for song for this episode was the song Look at Me by Jerry Halliwell, former Ginger Spice of the Spice Girls. It was her first single after she broke from the group, so she was embarking on her solo career. Like Sue is a solo as for the team in this issue. She's a British artist that's set in London. The song is Look at Me, whereas Sue at this time is sort of like very much the wallflower like we described. The song has a very kind of jazzy pop 60s feel to it, so I really like that. But that song came out in 2001, maybe 1999, somewhere around there. So it was just,
and
was
we
too
can't
modern.
Have anything
right
post 1977. That's the rule. Okay.
That's my rule, which I can break whenever I want, but I don't want to break it. So, having said all that, I went with the song You Won't See Me by, of course, The Beatles. Because if you have a story set in the UK, why not The Beatles? You Won't See Me, again, the title playing with invisibility. And the song literally says, when I call you up, and we talked about, Ben is calling Sue for help with a payphone. Later on in the song, there's a line, my hands are tied, just like Jessica is tied up by the webs in this one. So just, it felt apropos.
I mean, I listened to it, obviously, and this is all puns, in a way, when you compare it to this story. It's all about invisibility, not being seen, unseen. I felt like there was a lot of lines that hark towards this comic accidentally. And normally, you say, you won't see me, but you also won't hear me. Because normally I would put like a needle drop here where I, you know, you'd hear a bit of the song. But the Beatles are one of those bands that get you flagged immediately. Yeah. So, I mean, if you don't know your Beatles, I'm sure you can find them. Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel 2-in-1 number 31, starring The Thing and the Mystery Menace, Alicia Masters, and also Spider-Woman. You know, open up that mailbag.
Our first comment came from Rob Kelly. That name sounds familiar. I'm sure I've heard him in context. Rob said, the mystery guest gag hardly ever worked for team-up books, because, of course, the reader's imagination went places that could rarely be satisfied. The Brave and the Bold tried this trick for issue 150, and the guest star teaming up with Batman was Superman. While I long ago gave up Disney Plus and the Marvel shows, a miniseries delving into what it's actually like to work at Hydra could be really funny. Imagine clocking in each day not knowing if you were going to fight The Thing, Captain America, Daredevil, the Hulk, etc. Oh lord, not Power Man again.
Okay, Bucky749 offers a bunch of grim family team-ups, including one with Benji the dog. You know, that's the first movie I ever saw.
Wow. Oh.
Yeah, on the makeshift screen on the top level of my home village's city hall. He's got another one with K-pop demon hunters and another with the Flintstones where, well, he says Fred and Barney, so perhaps it's from the era where they're both beat cops. I don't know if anyone remembers that.
I don't.
But there was a Flintstones version where Fred and Barney are cops.
I did have K-pop Demon Hunters playing in my home for about a week a couple of months ago, thanks to, and I have this song golden permanently stuck in my head.
More than a week for me.
We got a comment from Scott Arthur who said, it's too bad. So he's addressing the non-problem that I mentioned before. He said, it's too bad you wanted to limit the song suggestions to releases preceding the comic. In December of 1977, about 6 months after the comic, the Rosillos released the A-side My Baby Does Good Sculptures, and he provided a link to it. I think in the past I may have made the excuse that if the song came out in the same year or within a couple of months, because I would argue that the song was written and possibly recorded before the issue, and it might have taken months before it was actually released. So that's a little cheat for me if I wanted to, but again.
I mean, music is like you go with your gut and what you think of. I thought you were pretty clever this time around to get to that. I don't know how you research these things or if they just come to you.
Some of them just come to me. And again, folks, like it's not the official soundtrack song, but if you want to check out the song Look at Me by Jerry Halliwell, it's a good song. I've always liked it.
And that was your gut instinct. So
that was. And it came to me right away.
Ange says, I can't help but love the mystery guest gag. My first one was also, just like Rob, BNB number 150, bought off the rack.
Two conflicting views on that issue.
Yeah. I also love how many people have been mutated into spider things over the course of Marvel Comics. Why not Alicia? As Ryan said, it is interesting to turn the I love the monster idea on its head in the Ben-Alicia relationship here. I can hear him gruffly say, hey, baby, put your arms around me, all eight of them.
We got a comment from Nate the Great who said, oh man, I must have been in a mood when I used that word last time. The situation with Ben and Alicia has always been kind of strange. I don't think that Stan and Jack meant anything bad with it. John Byrne had some very weird ideas about disabled people. See Action Comics 584. But they have had a rather unusual love life. However, if Ben were cured and Alicia could see, I don't think they would still be together. Maybe team them up with the Doom Patrol. What word was he talking about? So many months ago.
I'm not sure.
Was he
either
saying ableist or something?
Yeah, maybe.
To the second, or his later point, if Ben were cured and Alicia could see, I don't think they would still be together. I don't think I agree with that. I think if we assume that they kind of met under similar circumstances, if Ben was able or was permanently in his human form or could change at will, I mean, he's a catch. He's a good-looking guy. He's former military pilot, NASA pilot. He's, you know, there's no reason why Alicia wouldn't like him. And she's attractive on her own. He would dig her.
And no matter what, she's a sculptor. And I think part of the attraction was that he's a human sculpture.
Yeah.
So I think there would still be something there. And the eyesight or not, they would have been thrown into similar circumstances with her father being a supervillain and so on. Mm-hmm. So
I think that point sort of presupposes or is kind of based on the idea that her disability and his condition sort of make it so that no one else could love them. So they're kind of stuck together. And I don't buy that. I don't agree with that.
Tim Bryce says, since I binged through all of these stories at once, the mystery guest was no mystery at all. It was blatantly obvious from the previous issue. So it's a pretty bleh gag. It really would have been fine for this issue to be and Spider-Woman, just like the previous one. It was done in Marvel Team-Up at least once, like the Captain Britain two-parter. That's a good example. Although, that's a good point. Why didn't they use Captain Britain? So he asked the same question you did. My extensive research of asking Google shows he debuted the year before this issue, so he could have popped in. Makes as much sense as the other characters that have been in this storyline. But like I said, if you're following continuity, I think he's in the States at this point for a short stint.
We got a comment too from Martin Gray, who I think you just mentioned. You covered the Captain Britain team up with Spider-Man on a previous episode.
Yes.
Martin said, Marvel 2-in-1 has actually done the same covered guest star logo with Thor in both issues 22 and 23. As for the comic story, barring the sexy new look for Alicia, it was a bit dull. I think we had the same feeling.
Yeah.
Martin said, Siskoid, I don't think Chauncey is a nickname or diminutive. From Google AI, boo. The name Chauncey is of French and British origin, derived from the old French word chance, meaning chance or fortune. It originally functioned as a surname and was introduced to England after the Norman conquest of 1066, later evolving into a given name. The name can also refer to the Latin title Chancellor, or a French place name associated with high status or good luck.
So he's called Lucky. If you were American, he'd be called Lucky. He's a fortune hunter, so it's called Chauncey.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Okay,
yeah. I'm sure. Fine, okay.
Now explain Trevor.
Yeah. Finally, Martin says, funnily enough, we have had a comic about a day in the life of a Hydra agent in 2015. Hank Johnson, Agent of Hydra Issue 1, is on Marvel Unlimited, and it is a hoot.
Well, I do love comics about henchmen.
Yeah, I have not read that. I have heard of it, though. I forgot about that, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for teaming up with me, Ryan. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Several shows. You can always find me on Cheerscast. Comes out several Thursdays a month, right in the middle of season 9, pushing along toward the end of the series, which is still a few seasons away, but, you know, we're making a good effort. Also, you can find me and Chris Franklin once a month doing Batman Nightcast again, and months that have a fifth Thursday, you can hear me, Max Romero, and Paul Kinn covering Sandman Mystery Theater on The Sandman Slept Here, which is part of the Justice Society Presents feed.
All right. A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content and want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards and us to host all of the network's shows. Check it out at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. This month, we are proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. I got to talk to him about this new evil Robin Hood movie that's going to come out. We also enjoy reading your thoughts, and the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Ryan is back with us, but next month I'll be here with Bass as we continue our coverage of DC Comics Presents with issue 12 of that series. So on that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.